the UFC World Tour leading up to the Ronda Rousey fight there just began, and Ronda and Tate, Miesha Tate there, have been really going at each other in these media appearances. Apparently, the last meeting between the two on the tour, Ronda gave Miesha Tate the finger. So, just showing a lot of disrespect on her part. I don't know whether that's strategy or trying to hype up the fight or just she just doesn't like her. But it was kind of interesting. They had an interview with Ariel Helwani and Miesha Tate I listened to today. And we know a couple weeks ago we talked about how Ronda Rousey said that Tate was jealous of everything that she has, and Tate wouldn't be where she is if it wasn't for her. And surprisingly enough, as much as these two supposedly hate each other, Tate opened up to Helwani and really gave Ronda a lot of credit and said that, you know, she's right about a lot of that stuff. That, you know, she said, I would have never been in the body issue if Rousey didn't get there first. And I wouldn't be in the UFC if it wasn't for Rousey, I don't think. And as far as jealousy, though, she said the only thing she's jealous of is the fact that Rousey has the belt, and that's the only thing she really wants that Rousey has. But she even said she was proud of Rousey for getting the gig with the Expendables movie. So very interesting there. I didn't expect to hear that. Good on Tate for taking the high road in that situation, but Rousey's relentless. She's just trying to get under her skin and making the best of this period of hyping the fights to get on her. But one thing that Tate kind of slickly slid under the radar there was she said she doesn't know why, but it seems like every time they square off on the stage somewhere, she sees Rousey shaking. But even then, there was a chance for her to really nail Rousey on something, and she said, well, you know, I think it's just because she has a healthy fear of all her opponents. And it's more about respect than it is about, you know, being scared of her. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But that's just one of the stories we got. Another one here. What else we got? There's a boxing story that I thought I'd mention. Sounds like a rerun of an old issue, but there was a little bit of a confrontation in a bar over in Europe somewhere. I don't have the story right in front of me, but if I recall correctly, oh, here it is. It was in Ibiza, wherever that is. According to the Mirror, heavyweight boxers Derek Chisora and Vladimir Klitschko were involved in an altercation and had to be pulled apart by security over there. In a bad situation. No punches were thrown like the David Haye versus Chisora situation, which he really ended his career on. Haye did. But they've been trying to get a fight going. And they've had some issues before. Last year in Munich, Chisora actually spat water in Klitschko's face in the ring just before the world heavyweight title with his brother, Vitaly. And Chisora also created tension at the weigh-ins by slapping his opponent during their stare-down. And Chisora obviously went on to lose the unanimous decision to Vitaly. So they do have a history. But ESPN UK reported that this might have been a setup, at least on Chisora's part. Only last week, Chisora, in the aftermath of his win over Malik Scott, said he wanted to fight Vitaly. And it seems too far-fetched that the two just happened to take their holiday in the same area and be in the same nightclub in Ibiza at the same time. So, anyway, we'll see what happens if they actually fight each other. Let's see what else we got. And speaking of Vitaly Klitschko, his purse bid for a fight with Bermain Stiverne through the WBC has been postponed again. This was all supposed to be coming to pass because Stiverne upset Chris Areola on HBO this past April, which set it up for a super fight versus the Hall of Famer and longtime World Boxing Council World Heavyweight Champion, Vitaly Klitschko. The purse bid has been set and postponed, reset and repostponed, and finally on July 22nd, it was supposed to be the final purse bid, and again, the WC granted another extension requested by Team Klitschko. So they have to wait again now to set this up. I don't know what the story is behind the scenes, but it seems pretty shady to me. Stiverne is managed by Eye of the Tiger Management. It's the first I've heard of these folks, but pretty interesting name. So I don't know what's going to happen with that one, but I'd like to see them set that up one of these days. It'd be nice. So we'll see what happens there. Anyway. See what else we got. Demetrius Andrade versus Veins Martirosyan will happen on September 7th for the WBO Junior Middleweight title.
That's
going to be Andrade's first shot at a world championship. 12-round bout from the Staples Center in Los Angeles. It's also going to be on the same card as Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. versus Brian Vera. And we talked about Roy Jones Jr. earlier. He's actually going to be at an event in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Tony, on August 21st. So I don't know if that's in your neck of the woods. August 21st.
It's going to be Monday.
Right. Monday. Hold on.
It's a week. I know that. It's a
Wednesday.
According
to my calendar. Anyway. It's going to be seven action-packed bouts featuring boxers from the U.S., Mexico, and Puerto Rico. And Junior's going to be there. And tickets for the event are now on sale at artsquest.org. What do you got, your beeper on there, Tony?
Yes.
Your phone on vibrate? You're an important guy tonight, getting all these texts.
I am an important guy. I have a running joke for about a year and a half with one of my old coworkers. That every time we watch the Phillies and there's one scrub player, it's like a pinch hitter comes up, we always have a competition on who can text the other one first and say, "Your boy Nick." His name's Lance Nix. Who can be the first one to say, "Your boy Nick"?
Right.
Yes, we're very childish. And I told him I was trying to get him to buy some tickets from me for this weekend, and he just wouldn't go. And I said, "Do you dare me to bring a sign down there that says, 'Your boy Nick,' and get on TV with it?" I said, "That will trump anything. We don't have to change the number."
Interesting.
You know what else was funny today? The company that I used to work for treats their employees like shit. I mean, you know, the day before Thanksgiving, you can't leave till 5 o'clock. No closing early. If, you know, the 1 year I was there, 4th of July, was on Sunday. They made you come in and work for 4 hours on Saturday. You had to drive a half hour to get there and sit there and file papers for 4 hours because nobody called. It was treat their employees like shit. So now I'm at a place now, like, so I'm still in training, but they seem to treat their employees nice. So the one girl I used to work with texted me today, guess what? They're buying us breakfast and lunch today. Probably going to tell us they're closing the office because we're so far in debt. I said, wow, she goes, I bet you're jealous that we're getting breakfast and lunch. I said, let's look at it. I said, you know what I found out today? That they're giving us an extra holiday, Labor Day weekend. They're giving us August 30th off. customer service reps like me have to come in. We're getting paid time and a half for a day we expected to be there anyway, and we get another holiday for September or October at our discretion. I said, yeah. I said, I'm real jealous of you.
Anyway, I'm just sending an email to the Duva camp there trying to get a solution going here. Any minute. But while we're trying to cruise through this technical difficulty, we might as well bring up this discussion, the big controversy in the UFC about Benjamin Brinsa. The hooligan. I mean, you just have to look at the nickname to come up with the big clue about what he's into. And the UFC apparently didn't do much to look into this guy's background, because I think if they had known that this guy has ties to neo-Nazi movement over there in Germany, they probably wouldn't have signed him. And not too smart on their part, but what's even worse for me is that Dana White went out there on Twitter, which he knows is going to be seen by millions of people, whether they actually see the tweet or it gets reported later, and he says, oh yeah, we're going to have to look into this. Just totally showing his hand that they didn't look into it before, showing that they were negligent on this. It just blows my mind that they wouldn't do a cursory background check. This guy's actually banned from stadiums in Leipzig, Germany, where he's from. So if you can't even find out that before you sign the guy, I don't know how they're going to deal with this. Because
you know, they had a pretty interesting thread on the Underground about that. And, you know, like, a lot of the guys on there were saying if they had to start doing these checks on everyone that they're bringing in, I mean, sometimes the sport doesn't attract, shall we say, model citizens. You know
right.
what I mean?
Well,
they threw a guy out, though.
Guy just got thrown out of Bellator. Got thrown out of the UFC. He's drawing a blank on his name right now. Kathy, you might have to just continue this later.
All right,
we're live.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Everybody's on now. So, talk about your upcoming fight card this Saturday. Why don't you give us your take on the event and the series?
Sure. But we have a show. Yes, we have a fight on Saturday at NBC Sports the 10th of the Eastern Time. And we've got three great fights that are scheduled for television. Kirby Stevens fighting Saul Ronan, which we think is going to be a tremendous fight. We've got Tomasz Zemek fighting Dominic Wynn in another fight that should be very entertaining. And finally, we have a fight between Eddie Chambers and Tabitha Tuno of South Africa, which has been given five. So that way, we're expecting to be a very entertaining fight, so we're just encouraging everyone. There's no other boxing on Saturday night, so please tune in on NBC Sports at 10:30.
All right.
It's crazy. I'm out in the afternoon, but I should be home by that time, and I'll be able to make it in time, just in time to see it.
By the way, Kat.
I have the privilege of watching Eddie Chambers. I'm a Philadelphia guy. So I remember going to all the great fights at the Blue Horizon back in the day, and then the New Alhambra, then in South Philly, all those places. Mm-hmm. I remember getting to watch Eddie Chambers when he was really just starting out. You know, it was fifth, sixth, seventh pro fights.
And, you know, he's only 30 years old now. It seems like he's been around forever, but he really is a very young guy. Has a lot of career ahead of him.
Yeah, and I was saying before we got on the air, I watched, you know, like I said, I've seen Eddie fight down in the Blue Horizon a couple times, and I think the move to cruiserweight is really going to help him, because as fast as he was, hence the nickname Fast Eddie Chambers, I think he was really struggling a little bit when he was getting to those the much bigger guys, you know, the Klitschko brothers. I thought the fight he had with Adamak was a very competitive fight, a tremendous fight, and I said unfortunately he had to go through that fight with an injured arm. Well, I think you really could have won that fight.
I think he would have won that fight if his arm wasn't injured. So he's got, you know, it'd be nice to give him a chance to fight people his own size for a change and see what happens.
Yeah, very true.
And that was the perspective on this event. But basically, it just gave it. Tony, we're talking over each other here, one at a time. So what I was going to say is, it mentioned that this series is a real springboard for a lot of these fighters to get to the paid networks, and of course that paid off big time with the Jesus Soto Carras versus Andre Berto fight that we just saw this last Saturday. Can you tell us about that experience of seeing him on your series?
That's
and
right.
Then
Soto Carras was the first fighter who stepped into the ring on the first night of our NBC Sports Network series back in January of 2012. He fought Gabriel Rosado, and he didn't even win the fight, but he went on.
Okay, so you were just saying he didn't even win that fight, talking about Jesus Soto Carras.
Kathy. Right, Gabriel Rosado on that first show that we did back in January of 2012, and lost to Gabriel Rosado, but managed to parlay that into three appearances on premium cable, and now he's scored a huge upset against Andre Berto, and obviously he's going to keep moving on, and Gabriel Rosado also moved on into a couple of appearances on Showtime and HBO, and we've got a total there's 10 different guys who fought on the series in just 12 shows who have either been on, moved up to Showtime or HBO, or have are in serious discussions to be on those networks in the near future, or already have a fight scheduled there. In the case of Sergey Kovalev and Sergey Lajkovic and Antoine Smith, we're fighting on Showtime next week. Sergey Kovalev's got a world title fight on HBO on August 17th at 9 o'clock. On HBO, we're finding, in a very short period of time that there's only 12 shows, 10 different people. And there's probably going to be a few more as we go into the next few weeks.
Awesome.
I had the privilege of going to that first card on NBC, the one at the Asylum in South Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Remember it snowed that day, and we were like, we're lucky to clear it up in time for the fight. And I've known Gabe Rosado for about 7 or 8 years. I know his trainer, Billy Briscoe, very well. And I remember going down there, and Soto Carras, game performance. Rosado looked so good that night. He was so sharp. And I just remember telling people when that fight was over, I said, the crowd was so electric. It gave the main event fighters, Moose Byram and Brian Jennings, they had a hard fight to top. But I remember being there, and I said it was one of the headaches I enjoyed the most, because I'm such a fight fan. And I said I got to cover the fight. I got to meet Freddie Roach, who I've always admired, even when he was an understudy of Eddie Butch. And the one thing I'll really remember that, and it helped me gain a lot of respect for Soto Carras, who I'd never really seen fight much before. I might have seen him on ESPN here and there, but never really followed him. He took a lot of punishment that night, and he never went down. They stopped the fight, and you know how the reputation of Philadelphia fans can be, pretty harsh and pretty tough. But at the same time, Philadelphia boxing fans are known as being very knowledgeable, very passionate. And Soto Carras, after he lost the fight, went to each side of the ring, and he just acknowledged the crowd, and they all gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah.
And
yes,
that was such a classy move right there from both sides, from Soto Carras, because he fought in Rosado's hometown, and he was obviously he wasn't the favorite there. It was a Rosado crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so loud behind me, I couldn't hear. And even though he knew that they were rooting against him, he was still, willing to go out there and acknowledge him. And the fans were willing to give him that respect right back because of the effort that he put forth.
That's right. And the one thing I've noticed about this show, this series, and I've done this for a long time, been involved in a lot of different boxing series over the years, from USA Network to ESPN, some other things that we tried on NBC years ago. And one thing that has really struck me about this particular series and the way the fights have been lining up, there are no, I haven't seen a single guy go into a fight on this show with the attitude that I'm the opponent. Everybody. Right. Goes in there, and they're trying to win. They think they can win. We've had a lot of upsets, and that's one of the reasons why. There really isn't that mentality of, you know, Christians and Lions that you see on some boxing shows where half the card is, you know, foregone conclusion they're going to win, and the other half comes there to lose. These guys are all trying to win. They're all there expecting to win. And you know, you could feel it from that first show at the press conference when everybody got in the room together. You could realize that this is not a situation where the hometown guy is there to score a win. This is a situation where everybody's coming in and trying to win, like, you know, like their lives depend on it. And they all know that, you know, this is a launching pad, and it's proved itself to be that, and it's going to continue to be that. So that's how you get the best fights, that, and you have the best matchmakers. And I believe we have that with Russell Pelt and Jolene Mazzone.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, too, that, you know, even the stand-in guy, Dominic Gwynn, this weekend, has a lot better record than you usually find in people that step in at the last minute.
Dominic has frankly been calling us for the last year and a half saying, have you got anything? Have you got anything? To his credit, he's been waiting. So when we made the call, he didn't hesitate, and that's, again, part of what we're looking for here. And, you know, we've known Dominic a long time. He fought a good part of his career for Main Event years ago. And the thing about him is, it's funny, when his opponent is aggressive, his fights are tremendous. When his fights have been disappointing, it's been a situation where the guy's lying back waiting for someone else to make the fight. You know, this is about matchmaking, and that's what we try to think about. We don't just try to put one fighter in with another fighter because they weigh the same thing and the records are similar or something. It's really there's some thoughts put into this, and we wouldn't have put Dominic in with someone who was going to lay back and wait for the other guy to force the action, because that would not have made for a very interesting fight. But we think that fighting a guy like a Dominic who's going to be coming forward the whole time, it should be a lot of fun. It should be a great fight.
I was telling Rich before we got you on the air tonight, and we were talking about Dominic Gwynn being brought in as you know, a late replacement for this fight. I had the pleasure of seeing him fight live back in 2003 down in Atlantic City. He knocked out Michael Grant on the Gotti 1-3 undercard. And I had to go to that fight with my father and, you know, my neighbor and his brother-in-law. You know, we got those tickets on day one, because you knew by day two you weren't going to be able to get them.
That's true.
And, you know, Michael Grant lives only about 20 minutes from me. I'm about 20 minutes away from Norristown, PA, and I've never met him personally, but I know people that know him. And we had gone to one of his fights at the Philadelphia Spectrum about 5 or 6 months prior, and he was letting his opponent, who was much shorter, much lighter, and, you know, was a sub-500 fighter, he was letting this guy fight him in close, and he wasn't using his height, his reach, his strength, or his athleticism. And I remember that night, we were waiting for the undercard fights, and I turned to my dad and my neighbor, and I said, you know, this is not going to be an easy fight for Grant. I said, Gwynn, I think, was undefeated at the time, and I know he's got about a 5-inch height disadvantage, and weight was about, you know, about 30 to 40 pounds that he was giving up to Grant. But I said, if Grant tries to fight lackadaisical and let Gwynn fight him in close, he's going to be in a lot of trouble. And by the third round, I think when he first got rocked pretty good, and I think the knockout was, it was an odd number round. That sticks in my head for whatever reason. It was either the seventh or the ninth. And as I told Rich, I said, it was a less dramatic version of the Ivan Drago Apollo Creed knockout when Grant just did a face flop, you know, right on the canvas. Rich made fun of me because my memory for trivial details like that is way, way, way too crystal clear.
Yeah,
it's from the press selection.
We sometimes call him the...
I was there, too. I was there at the fight. I don't remember what happened. Dominic's been in some really exciting fights, and we expect it we're going to see on Saturday. I thought, this is not a walkover by any means. It's going to be a test. It might be, in my opinion, it may be a tougher fight than the one that it's replaced. So we'll see.
It could be. Now, Kathy, give us a little insight on how you got involved in boxing to begin with. What got you started?
When I was 20 years old, I met my husband, Dan Duva, and we started dating. And wasn't long after that that he asked me to help out with their family business. They were putting on boxing shows. I was a newspaper reporter at the time, and I had and during that period that we were dating, I had transitioned into working as a publicist at a local college. And so I had to write press releases because I was the only one who knew how. So that's how I started. And we worked together for years and years, and had a tremendous marriage and a tremendous family and great business together. And then he passed away in 96. And a few years after that, once I got myself some education and spent some time with my kids, and when I was ready to go back to work, I came back, and this is what I still do. So I'm on it now, and when he passed away, Main Event was really one of the major forces in boxing. It was Top Rank and Main Event and Don King, and a lot has changed since then, and we're starting to build it back up, and we're having a good time.
Awesome. That's kind of sort of how I got my start, except it didn't involve any dating anyone. But when I first boxed in college, I wrote my own stories about my fights and the whole team at Virginia Military Institute. And I kept up the writing. I wrote for some newspapers, and then I started the website, FightNewsUnlimited.com. So
it
kind of
came
from the same area there. Over the years, what would you say you've grown to love most about the sport of boxing?
I think the thing I love is that moment before the fight starts. I can't get that out of me. There were times in the last 17 years where I thought about maybe I should just move on, do something else, whatever, find another life. But everyone who's involved in this sport, I think there comes a point when you realize you're up. And I couldn't walk away. There's just that moment when you sit there in the corner, and you're lucky enough to be sitting up front like we do, and you know the guy in the corner, and everything's riding on his success, and the bell rings. It's just nothing like it. I don't think there's anything in the world that's more exciting. So I guess I'm an adrenaline junkie. I just can't stop.
That reminds me of starting my school boxing team back at Norwich University up in Vermont. And we didn't have anything resembling a boxing team. We didn't even have a boxing club when I got there. So I started everything from scratch, spent $1,500 of my own money on equipment, and even got the school eventually to authorize insurance to have fights on campus. And I remember the first night I went into the mess hall, and I got on the loudspeaker and I said, "We're having Friday night fights downstairs in the mess hall tonight." And I got such a reception from the mess hall crowd. I couldn't believe it. Like, I was kind of looking around like, are they clapping for me? Are they cheering for me? What's going on? And I got a tremendous amount of people to show up from campus every Friday night for the next few weeks, that maybe before the fights, before you even throw a punch, where it compresses you the most. People love fights. People just love a fight.
They do. Yeah, I think it's just something, it's just something in it, and a lot of people are going to deny it. Max Kellerman gives this tremendous analogy all the time. He says, if you're standing on a street corner and there's a baseball diamond on one corner and there's a basketball court on the other, and third corner there's a tennis court, and a fourth corner a fight breaks out, where are you going to look? And that's about it. That says it all.
I was over a friend of mine's house the other day. I grew up with him. We've been friends since we were 7 years old, going on 30 years now. And, when I boxed in college, I almost fought Rich in the Nationals in 1 year. I fought for Lock Haven University. And, I had a great time there. And, I always remember the excitement. I thought was the most exciting. You got your hands taped. because then you knew it was game time. You know, it was it's showtime. It's time to go. And he never got to come, you know, up to the college to see me fight. He was, you know, working at the time. And a couple years later, we were getting ready for, he had just turned 30, back in 2006. And he was talking about wanting to go to a professional fight. He'd never been to one. And I said, I got one coming up that I think you'll want to go to with me. And I didn't tell him I already had the tickets. But I took him a few months later for his birthday. I took him to the Arturo Gatti-Carlos Baldemir fight. And he was a diehard Gatti fan, even more so than I was, which was, you know, pretty amazing. And as we all know, Gatti lost that fight. It was his last title fight, you know, before you know, he retired a year later. And the crowd was so electric, and he was so excited. When we left, you know, we were all disappointed, except him. And he was still saying, he was still shaking. He was in the car. He was literally shaking. And I saw him this weekend, and we were talking about it. And he goes, you know what? He goes, yeah, the fight was, you know, it was disappointing, but at the same time, I got to see him before he retired, and I got to see that environment. And I told him, I said, Mike, I said, I wish I could have taken you to the third Gatti Ward fight with me. That was the one I only went to, you know, that one, Gatti Ward 3. And I said, our seats for that one were, not that they were better, but it was a better angle, because when we went to the Baldemir fight, we were almost right above where they were walking out to the ring. For the Ward fight, we were on the exact opposite. So after the Dominic Wynn-Michael Grant fight was over, and you knew what was coming up next, and you could just feel the crowd with that electricity, and that fire, just, and everybody was getting so excited. And then from where we could see the, like, almost the tunnel before the rest of the crowd could see the fighters. We could see Ward come down that tunnel before he was about to enter the arena. And we just started losing it. And then when Gatti came out, we couldn't hear anything. And that feeling never left.
That was loud, boy.
And when that fight was over, we were walking out of the arena, and I was drenched in sweat. I said, you gotta be kidding me. I said, I didn't even get in the ring. I'm up in the cheap seats. I said, I'm sweating more than they are.
Yeah, yeah. When that Thunderstruck started playing, every time it got so loud. That night was just the loudest thing I've ever heard. And, you know, after the Baldemir fight, we were in the casino and people were walking up to him and congratulating him. And I guess they must have had the same reaction as your friend. And he turned to me and he said, "Why are they congratulating me? I lost." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Because they're going to get to tell their kids that they got to shake your hand." And he didn't understand it. He never understood it. He was dumbfounded by that. The sad thing about Arturo is he never really understood, like, how people worshipped him or why, or how they affected him or how he changed their lives. I wish he had, but that's the thing about that night that struck me, was how surprised he was. And I was a little surprised by the reaction of people who were running up to him saying, hey, champ, congratulations. And he's looking at me. I said, they don't care that you lost. That's not why they came. They didn't come to see win, they came to see fight. And he didn't get it.
Even as my friend said, like, I didn't care that he lost. It was still Arturo Gatti. Yeah. What was
exactly.
Really cool for me, when I was 15, my dad had taken me to a few fights when I was a real, real, real little kid that I don't even remember. But the first fight I ever say that I went to was a pay-per-view fight back in 1992. Between Michael Moore and Bert Cooper down at the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. Great fight.
Yeah, I was there too.
But that was the same night I think Gatti had his 5th professional fight. And what was cool about it was I'm sitting there with my cheaper seat. I liked AC/DC. So I'm sitting there and I'm dancing in my seat. This 15-year-old kid, you know, I think I'm cool. You know, and my dad's looking over to me, and that's when Gatti comes out. He has a real bushy hairstyle. And my dad goes, and I'm jamming with the song. My dad goes, oh, boy, I guess I know who you're rooting for. And about these years later, we're still talking about it right now.
Yeah. So, I think they'll be talking about it a lot longer than that. It's go history.
Now, best moment so far as a promoter.
After the loss to Alfonso Gomez, I wrote a tribute article. You know, being a writer, I wanted to write something that Rich could post on Fight News Unlimited, and I wrote a tribute article. Just what being a Gotti fan meant to me. And then when he passed away 2 years later, I was talking to a friend of mine. I'm like, man, I said, I really should write something as kind of like a eulogy. And my friend looked at me and he goes, that article you wrote 2 years ago is almost perfect. And I said, you know what? It was the ultimate tribute article to the ultimate blood and guts warrior. I said, I'm just going to rewrite the foreword to it. And then represent the article as I did, and we posted it, and a lot of positive comments on it. I tried to get it into some major sports publications like Sports Illustrated with no luck, but it was just that passion that he brought is what resonated with me. I mean, that article was easy to write. It just flowed because that's almost the way he would have, you know, that what he brought to the ring, it was like I brought to the pen.
Yeah, it was something special, boy. Very special.
Yeah.
We still miss him.
Now, Kathy, what would you say was your best moment as a promoter so far?
It was promoting those Gotti Ward fights. That was it. Because especially bringing the second one to Lake City, because that was something that I did. And over the objections of a lot of other people, and I'm happy it worked out because I think those fights became so much bigger because of where they were, and that was my proudest moment. Was making all that happen and selling them out so quickly and seeing it all come together the way it did. It was thrilling to be associated with it.
And how about who were your role models growing up that? You know, we're either inside or outside the sport of boxing that kind of gave you a good head on your shoulders to get started in this business.
Well, I grew up in Normandy. My late husband, you know, was my best friend and my mentor and you know, everything. And everything I know, I learned from him. Everything I am, I owe to him. You know, as far as the role models, especially as a woman, there weren't any. Until Eileen Eaton followed her husband she ended up in the Boxing Hall of Fame. She's, I guess, my idol. She ended up in the same situation that I did, where her husband passed away after she'd worked with him for many years, and she ended up taking over his business and being successful. So I guess it's hard, but I don't really know much about her or anything except that, you know, I ended up in the same situation. But, yeah, I really just, as I said, I... Dan and I kind of figured out what we were doing as we were going along, and we managed to make it work. So I'm just continuing what he taught me.
Great.
So I guess it's him.
Now, as far as the politics of boxing goes, I know a lot of people are having issues with decisions in recent years. You know, there's a lot of talk about there's too many belts and too many junior and regular world championship belts. What do you see as the biggest problem in boxing, and what can be done to fix it?
I think the biggest problem in boxing is that we have a hard time finding sponsors. We have a tremendous sport that people love to watch. When we put it on television, we get huge audiences. We get bigger audiences than most of the other sports. On NBC Sportsnet after hockey, we're the next highest rated thing on the network. When fights are on, you know, any other, when we go on NBC Network, the ratings have been astonishing. People flipping through channels, they stop, they watch, they love it. The thing that holds the sport back is that unlike every other major sport, sponsors are not particularly attracted to us. And part of it is because our audience tends to be older, and advertisers like young people. Part of it is, you know, it's kind of a, boxing has got more of a little bit of a seedy kind of look to it than you know, one or high football.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Excuse me, I couldn't hear that.
That's interesting. I was just going to mention that, I guess that's why ESPN has Just for Men, the hair coloring as a sponsor.
Yeah, Yes, it is one. And, you know, because here's the thing, the demographics skew kind of old. But part of, you know, and they say, well, guys like MMA. Well, MMA was on Spike TV, a network that is built for young men. It was hyped beautifully. You know, Spike TV did a tremendous job of finding that audience and catering to it. The producers, you know, from UFC put on a broadcast that was very kid-friendly. That is, you know, when you think about boxing, it's on premium cable late on Saturday night, late on Friday night. Young people aren't watching TV then. And only a third of the country has premium cable. So it seems to me that the way we're going to get a younger demographic, because I do think young guys like violent sports, if they like MMA, I can't imagine they wouldn't like a great fight. But we don't get exposed to them. They don't see it. Most guys don't really discover boxing until they get into their 20s, and now they've, they're paying off their school loans, or they've gotten a girlfriend, or they've gotten married, and now they're living in an apartment. They can't go out at night all the time anymore, and they stop going out on Saturday night, and then they start watching the fights. And, until we find a younger audience, or until we find sponsors that are interested in reaching an older audience, we're going to struggle. And frankly, you know, talk about sanctioning bodies and belts. I really don't think that's the issue at all. I never did. I think it's nice for the fighters when they win a belt. It makes them very happy. They work really hard for them and give them as trophies. It's nice to be recognized. And I don't know a single fighter who ever said, I don't want to fight for that belt. Don't have a problem with belts. They don't have as big a problem with decisions as people seem to have from time to time. If you think about the judges, they're sitting on three different sides of the ring than the TV announcers are, and they are not on the same side that the cameras are. The announcers are looking at the same picture that you're seeing, but just on three other sides. You're getting three different perspectives. Not being seen on TV. They are not discussing the fight with a neighbor. They are not following on Twitter. They are not talking to the guys you see next to them or listening to what the announcers are saying on TV. There's some hearing and hearing the crowd and spreading their own
information. Breaking up a little bit there.
So I think that's partly television jobs playing.
My suggestion, I actually mentioned it to another promoter, was maybe the judges should get the punch stat numbers between rounds of, you know, how many punches landed and what kind and everything before they write down their final number. But the promoter I brought that up to said, well, those numbers can be inaccurate too, so it's not really.
Yeah, those are two guys pushing buttons when they see a punch. So it's another subjective impression. They're choosing, is that a hard punch? Is that a jab? You know, did they push the button fast enough? That's the problem with that. I mean, anytime you bring in subjective judging, people are going to argue, but I find that a lot of the times that you see people arguing, they're arguing over a one-point fight. And, you know, it came down to, for example, the fight between Tomas Adamek and Steve Cunningham. If one judge had scored one round differently, you would have the opposite result.
Right.
And when it gets that close, you can't yell that somebody got robbed. Because
yeah.
Those judges on the other three sides of the ring, they have seen something very different than you watching it on television. I was in a fight not long ago. Another one that people complained a little about was the draw between Glasgow and Malik Scott. I was sitting on the same side of the ring as the judge who had Glasgow winning. And what I saw on the side of the ring that I was sitting, which was the opposite side from where the TV camera was a lot of great big shots that left hook to the body. But the Glasgow's back was to the camera most of the time when those were being thrown. And what you could see from the other side of the ring was he was blocking every single one of them with his wrist. Every single one of them. And you couldn't see that on the other side of the ring.
Yeah, myself, I was at a fight in Vegas at the Cosmopolitan. I think it was a couple of years ago now. And there ended up being I think we lost Kathy. We'll call her back. But finish my thought. She doesn't necessarily need to hear this, but there ended up being a low blow that the judge scored, or the referee scored a low blow, and then the cameraman came up to me.
Her call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
We'll try back in a minute. The cameraman came up to me and showed me the picture that he took, and it was right on the belt line. It was actually sort of above the belt line, just kind of grazing it with the glove part. And he took it at the very moment the punch landed. So it can happen, you know, different perspectives give you a whole different
call
outlook.
Has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging.
Maybe your battery died or something. She went out of range. But we'll try to get her back before the end of the show here. We only got about 18 minutes. But while we're taking a break here, I guess we might as well preview the big UFC fight this coming weekend. Big, I think it's UFC 163. Big main event there is a title fight again, just like the last UFC fight. But it's different weight. We got Jose Aldo versus Chan Sung Jung. And known as the Korean Zombie there. I don't know what his chances are. I know that Aldo's one of my favorite fighters. He's one of the pound for pound best in the world. 22-1 going into this fight. Sun Young is 13-3. So we'll see how that goes. But I definitely think that that we've got Aldo as the favorite there, and he's probably going to steamroll over Young. But you never know how hungry.
Yeah, I would agree. But I think that I understand why, you know, when Pettis couldn't go forward with the fight. I understand why they got the Korean Zombie to step in. It makes sense. He's earned the shot. But having said that, my money's on Aldo.
And we got a pretty interesting main event at light heavyweights. We got Lyoto Machida, who's 19-3, versus Phil Davis, who's 11-1. I don't think Davis has really been tested against the best talent in the division. And although Lyoto's had better days in the past when he was champion, Phil Davis is no pushover, so I think this is going to be a very competitive fight.
I think styles make fights, and I think it's a tough matchup for Phil. I mean, with that elusiveness of Machida, he's a hard guy to take down.
And then in third fight on the card, we've got Cesar Ferreira versus Thiago Santos. As if we needed another Thiago in the UFC. Well, we got one. Thiago is 8-1. Ferreira is 5-2. I don't really know much about either of these guys. I have not seen either of them fight before, but, you know, if they're that high on the card, it ought to be a pretty good matchup. And then we've got two huge, big-time, long-time UFC veterans, MMA veterans in general. Teles Leites, who's 20-4, versus Tom Kong Watson, who's 16-5. And that should be a pretty competitive bout there. Both guys with pretty comparable records and experience against big names. Definitely the guys with the most experience on this card are in the next fight. And that's John Lineker versus Jose Maria Tomei, who's... Tomei is 33-3. Had a lot of fights there. And Lineker is 21-6. So they've got almost 60 fights between the two of them there. Pretty impressive. And then we've got Vinny Magalhães, who's 10-6, versus Anthony Perroche, who's 13-7. We got another female fight, Amanda Nunes, who's 7-3, fighting Sheila Gaff, who's 10-5-1. Don't know much about either of those two, but I have heard of Nunes. I think I saw her on the last Invicta card, if I remember correctly. Sergio Moraes, who's 7-2, will be going up against Neil Magny, who's 8-1. And we've got Ian Uncle Creepy McCall, who's 11-4-1, fighting Iliarde Santos, who's 27-7-1. We got WEC veteran Ronnie Yaya, 18-7, fighting Josh Clopton, 6-1-1. Francimar Barroso, 15-3, fighting Ednaldo Oliveira, who's 13-1-1, and one of the old Ultimate Fighter veterans, Bristol Marunde, guy who I thought would be the favorite in his season. I think the one that was actually the one that Michael Chiesa won, the live season, I think. He's 12-8, fighting Viscarde Andrade, who's 14-5 to start off the preliminary card. So let's try Kathy one more time here. See if we can get her back on before we close out the show.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
Kathy Duva.
Well,
is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you finish recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
I'll just say thanks on her message anyway.
To leave a callback number, press 5.
Hey, Kathy, this is Rebel Rousing Rich Bergeron. We just wanted to give you a shout-out and much thanks for doing the interview with us tonight. We're sorry we had to cut it short due to these technical difficulties. We've unfortunately were unable to connect with you before the end of the show, it looks like. But definitely look forward to the big event this weekend, and I wish you the best of luck in the future, and thank you very much for coming on the show with us tonight. And have a good night, and we'll try to keep in touch. Maybe we'll do a second take one of these days under better circumstances. So thanks a lot. So there's Kathy Duva. And
Rich, you have a few moments. I don't know if you guys got to see the dueling HBO or Showtime cards the other night, but pretty good. Pretty good, boxing on TV.
Yeah, we mentioned Jesus, but not much else. Go ahead. Give us the rundown.
Well, we got a lot to run down. I'm just pulling up to pronounce all the names correctly right now, for just a moment, but I'll get it right here. I don't want to mispronounce the Japanese fighter's name. After the performance in the Dutch T-shirt, he definitely deserves to have his name pronounced correctly. So I'll do both HBO and Showtime, and I was saying with HBO, because it was over in China, they had to brought out like their broadcasting from nobody that wanted to do the show, because they had Larry Merchant on there, who they pretty much cut ties with. George Foreman, who hasn't really done HBO commentating in a long time, and I don't even know who the other one was. The main event over in China was the phenomenal. Well, we have Zhang Zhuang. He knocked out Cullen. I don't think that was what I'm looking for here. I got to maybe look on the 28th for that one, because technically I was looking at the wrong date. So where the hell is that one? Okay, let me go back to my search. I'll do China first, and then I'll do Texas. Because China and Texas are, so similar. They're both big, I guess.
Well, while we're waiting for you to look that up, I did want to mention that yesterday the Association of Boxing Commissions wrapped up their annual meetings, and the last topic of discussion was a rule change in the UFC, or MMA in general, about grounded fighters, strikes to the head of grounded fighters, or at least knees to the head of grounded fighters, I believe, were outlawed at some point, but they're contemplating a rule change based on situations where guys are looking like they're purposely trying to draw a foul by putting their hand on the mat, which is technically kind of like a boxer getting a knockdown for putting his glove on the ground, or getting into a position where he has to put his glove on the ground to stabilize himself. Well, MMA fighters are doing this on purpose, putting their hand on the ground to look like they're grounded, so that if a guy knees him, he gets a penalty. And the last big event where it happened was Dodson versus Johnson, the flyweight title fight there that went to decision. And that could have been a very crucial point taken away if they had taken a point away. But they didn't take the point away. They just stopped the action and let Dodson recover there. But now they're contemplating just wiping that out so that the referee can make a decision whether guy's doing it on purpose and he can let the guy knee or not. So they're leaving it entirely in the hands of the referee, and the fight wouldn't be stopped in that situation if it happened again. So I think that's a good move, but it's far from the soccer kicks to the head that a lot of fans want to see again from Pride. So I just thought I'd mention that real quick. You got all your stuff up now, Tony?
I got the results from China. Title fight on the card was Evgeny Gradovich. Good tough fight with Mauricio Javier Munoz. A lot closer than the scorecards had it. You know, the scorecards had two of them had it 119-109, the other had it 120-108, pretty much given Gradovich every round. It wasn't that easy of a fight. You could say he did win every round, but it was competitive, we'll put it that way. It was a very competitive fight. Also on the card, you have the fighter Zhu Shiming, who's a very highly touted Chinese prospect. He's now 2-0, hasn't knocked anybody out yet. 32 years old. I think he was the one that was the Olympian.
Yep. Yeah, he's been in the news these last couple of weeks just for the fact that he's been signed to a pro contract. Big news over there in China.
Let's get down to Texas, because that's where we had some good fights. We talked about the Andre Berto, Jesus Silva Carrasco fight. Good fight. Earlier, the first fight of the night, we had Keith One-Time Thurman and Diego Gabriel Chavez in a fight where somebody's O had to go. And Thurman took some lumps early. Chavez is really bringing it to him. Thurman started boxing a little bit better, and he scored a knockdown in the ninth round with a hard body shot, and then really took all the air out of Chavez. He got him up against the ropes, and pretty much put him down, put him out. 10th round knockout, impressive performance, and then probably the next one I'm going to talk about, fight of the weekend. And it was, as my dad watched the fight, he says it was one of those fights where if he was the fighter, the manager of either fighter, he'd never let them fight each other again. Just because they beat each other up too bad. We had young Omar Figueroa, 23 years old. He was 21-0, 17 knockouts coming into the fight. And he's taken on a fighter that was 24-2, Mihito Arakawa, Japanese fighter. And early on, it looked like Figueroa was going to blow him out of there. He was hitting him with some hard shots. What I really liked that he was doing was every time he landed a shot to the head, he'd go right to the body. And finally, he put Arakawa down in the second round. Okay, this fight ain't going to last much longer. And then Arakawa, next thing you know, he's just throwing punches. And he's throwing punches. And you could see Figueroa was getting a little discouraged. He's getting hit. And, it's like, man, it's like, is this kid going to be able to take it? Puts Arakawa down again in the sixth. Arakawa gets back up and just kept throwing punches. When it was over, Arakawa was busted up pretty good. I mean, especially underneath his right eye. Looked like he had a softball underneath his right eye. I mean, it was nasty looking. His left eye was swollen. And what I liked about it was that every round, they either touched gloves or nodded to each other. They were just saying, I'm here, and the better man's going to win. They were very complimentary to each other in the post-fight interview. And I said, this is what makes boxing look good. You get two guys fighting their heart out, but at the same time showing a lot of class while they're doing it. I think Figueroa should take a little bit of time off for his next fight. I know he's, trying to fight every few months, but he took a lot of punishment in this fight. And I know he said he hurt his hands on Arakawa's concrete dome. It was an enjoyable night of boxing on both networks, sucked. They were competing against each other, but I was you know, happy to get a chance to watch them and just enjoy good boxing.
Cool. Well, before we get off the air, I definitely think we should chat a little bit about the Bellator event last night. We only mentioned the fight that didn't happen, but the fight that got announced at the event. The main event was pretty thrilling. Talk about an amazing knockout. The caveman got clubbed over the head instead of the other way around. David Rickles ended up getting the bad end of Michael Chandler's best night in the cage, and just got hit with a heck of a, I think it was a right hand that started it all, and then a little bit of ground and pound. Or it, I don't even know if he even got to that point. I think what happened was he got clubbed with one hand, and then Rickles kind of staggered and stood back up, and then he got hit with the equalizer. They had King Mo.
Yeah, Chandler looked great.
Yeah, very ferocious, which, you know, he's not. He's usually a little bit more technical, I think they were even saying in the commentary, but he's definitely got his striking game up another notch for that one. And King Mo actually went back to his wrestling to pull out a win in his fight, his comeback from having a tough loss last time out. So that's encouraging.
Yeah, I think that was a very smart move. Very smart move. Stay with your roots.
And, geez, I felt bad for Jacob Noe because he showed a lot of heart and bled a lot and kept going. And he had that look on his face like he didn't want to be there, but he still. And finally the ref had to call it off. We had Ben Askren. I forget his opponent's name. He had such a good fight, but it wasn't very exciting as usual. And he was kind of throwing arm punches at the end of this whole thing when it got called off, but. It is what it is. That's his style. He still dominates with it, so you know, you can't really criticize it. And we had a couple heavyweights there. I don't remember what the outcome of that was, but I know Ryan Martinez lost. I forget the other guy there. Is this everybody? Ryan Martinez was defeated by Vitaly Minnikov by TKO due to strikes in the third round at the 4:02 mark, so just inside a minute left in the fight there, and also the last main card fight, actually the first one on the televised portion of the card was Patricio Pitbull taking out Jared Downing, also by TKO due to strikes in the second round at the 54-second mark. So that pretty much wraps up the Bellator card there. And unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties tonight, and we had to start a backup taping about an hour into the show. So we ended up losing about an hour, but we got the whole Kathy Duva interview that we were able to get tonight. So we apologize for the little issues, but until next week, we're going to sign off, and we should be all set to go back in business and at full strength next week. So until then, folks, adios, and enjoy the fights.